I think there is a need to rethink the high street because it's such an important part of people's daily life. And the reality is that a lot of high streets are just falling apart. And I think that is a huge shame. And I don't think the government have really got to grips with how to deal with it.
Today, I'm sitting down with Daniel Rubin, who is the founder of Dune. It's one of our most beloved shoe brands. And he's been at it, yes, for 50 years. I mean, it's half a century. I mean, he's basically a legend in British footwear. And Daniel has just released his memoir, Soul Survivor, and it was fascinating to talk to him. I reminded him there weren't many like him out there. And I love the fact that when you sit down with these founders, especially someone who has weathered decades worth of business, it actually just comes back to some of the fundamental truths about the vision you have, the, I suppose, perseverance it takes, and then the ability to stand the storms and the roller coaster of getting to where you believe a brand should exist. You know, I think this is what was amazing about this conversation. It's 50 years of a journey, doing something that's not easy to do, having a family legacy, the commitment to a dream that you start, how easy would it be to just jump ship when things become too difficult, and how hard it is to stay in the game, to keep evolving, to keep changing, to keep moving. It's one of my favourite kind of founder stories, these ones that have evolved over decades of time and shows you really what it means to be an entrepreneur. So make yourself a cup of tea, enjoy that dog walk, and just enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Daniel, it's such a pleasure to be speaking to you today. Thank you for joining Conversations of Inspiration.
Well, it's very much my pleasure.
I want to introduce you as a shoe empire founder. Everything from your family dynasty of shoemakers to your brand new book, Soul Survivor, your memoir on building the shoe empire that is Dune London. And so I just cannot wait to get into this because, quite frankly, I think a lot of people here will be going, oh my goodness, is there, do you know what I mean? Is this an actual founder-led business still on our high streets? Because it's a rarity.
It certainly is. There aren't many of us left. I mean, most of them have either sold out to private equity or gone public or been taken over. But you're right, I'm one of the few sole survivors in that sense. One of the few independently owned sort of retail brands out there. So,
yeah.
So yes, that's right.
I love it, firstly. I think everyone will love this conversation. But your book, we were just talking when we were off camera, so to speak, has literally just been released. And I can imagine it's a real moment for you. You're sharing all the insights and the stories from your 50 years in fashion and footwear industry. That's half a decade, right? Was it a cathartic experience, you know, reflecting on 50 years? And I've just got my copy today and I'm looking through it and it's got pictures that go really far back. Was it a pleasure to do?
It was. It was amazing, actually. I mean, my son said to me, how did you remember all that from 50 years ago? You know, did you keep a journal? And I didn't keep a journal, but once I started writing, and I actually quite enjoyed the whole process of writing, a whole load of memories just came flooding back, going right back to, you know, my school days, my youth, mm-hmm. when I started off in manufacturing, qualifying as a chartered accountant. So yeah, it was, I think the word is good. It was a cathartic experience, and it was really fascinating just sort of remembering all the different things that happened over the last 50 years. Some good, some more challenging, but overall, I guess overall, very enjoyable.
I want to go back in this podcast. We go right the way back. So I know your family history plays a huge role in your story, and I loved learning about it when I was researching you. I read that your grandfather emigrated from Russia to London at the turn of the 19th century and found work as at a shoe workshop before opening his own manufacturing factory in 1925. And your father then also went into the family business. So you're from a long line of cobblers and shoemakers, and it runs basically in your blood. It was a thriving industry then. Do you have memories of visiting the business as a child?
I do. I went to my father's factory, which was in Stoke Newington, in now quite a so fashionable part of London. Then it was not a particularly salubrious place to go. And I do remember going there, and I remember the noises and the smells and just the complexity. I mean, it's so many different processes in making a pair of shoes. I think, you know, I think something like 150 processes. So trying to organize it, it was like organized chaos. And my father was very much the sort of very hands-on. I mean, everybody, you know, I remember people coming into his office every 5 minutes asking for instructions. So yes, it was interesting. And as you say, at that stage, there were quite a few manufacturers in London, and there was very good camaraderie between them. But yeah, I didn't go a lot to the factory because I was sent away to school when I was 13. So I didn't go that much, but I do remember those few visits, certainly.
And I have to say straight away, it reminds me of the great Sir John Timpson, whose great grandfather opened the first Timpson shop in 1860s. And yet, despite sort of, you know, this dynasty of shoemakers in your family, your dad actually warned you off. And I remember John talking about a similar thing, warned you off joining the family business. It was almost like maybe they sort of knew really what it was like. Why do you think that was? And was that because it was such a tough industry? Because he suggested that you become a chartered accountant, which, quite frankly, is that not just the absolute opposite?
You're quite right. I mean, I think number one, in those days, you tended to listen to your father a little bit more.
Yes.
I was useless at maths. I failed maths O-level. The most successful member of the family was our uncle Harvey, who was a chartered accountant. And therefore, I think my father felt, well, you know, if you follow him in his footsteps, you won't be going far wrong. And so it wasn't easy qualifying as an accountant. But with hindsight, I think it was a very good decision because, you know, understanding finance, understanding how to read a balance sheet, although I wasn't a good accountant, it certainly sort of set me up, I think, in good stead. It was surprising in a way because my father didn't have a bad life. You know, he was playing golf twice a week. He you know, we had a very, very nice sort of childhood, a really nice house in Hampstead Garden suburb. So I was surprised in a way, but I think, you know, I think he was right. I think, you know, making shoes is not easy. As I said, there are lots of processes, a lot of challenges. And I guess he mostly thought there are easier ways for you to make a living, Daniel, than to sort of make shoes.
Yeah.
So that was his advice.
Excuse the pun, but follow in his footsteps. You know, that there's something, isn't there, that parents, and I know, try and do, don't they? They try and sort of stop you making the same mistakes, but you didn't see it really as a mistake.
Well, I did. I mean, it took me sort of about, you know, I qualified as an accountant, then I went into banking, then I became a corporate financier and a finance director. So it wasn't until I was 30, when my father was unwell, that I finally decided to go into manufacturing. Before that, I didn't really have any, you know, inkling that I would become a manufacturer. But he was doing well at the time. It was in the 70s. It was the days of Bieber. I don't remember Bieber, you know. It
was, yes, sort of, yes.
He was making lots of high leg boots. They were selling fantastically well. His health wasn't very good. And I was a bit of a loose end. I mean, I was working for a demolition company. I didn't really see that as my future. So I went to help him. And 50 years later, here I am, still in the footwear industry.
The changes that you must have seen, was that right? And when I was looking up, this was like 1976, was that right, around then?
Yes, yes.
That you were going into this. The changes that you must have seen over the years and how it's impacted that business. I mean, because I think this is where your experience and your wisdom of 5 decades in an industry, but you must have seen it all. What have been those sort of those changes from when you were helping out your dad to now?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the big theme of the book is all about change. The first major change was that production just moved away from the UK, and in particular London, and went to the Far East. And now, apart from Northampton, where they make beautiful men's shoes, there isn't much shoe manufacturing left because it's a low-technology, high-labor-content business, ideally suited to, you know, growing countries like, well, originally it was Taiwan, but then China, Vietnam. So that's the first thing that's happened. You know, manufacturing has just left the UK.
Am I right in thinking that you went to the Far East for sort of 3 months and you witnessed almost this change yourself?
Absolutely right. You know, I had a factory. We were making, my father unfortunately died, and I joined my uncle, bought 50% of his business, and we were making shoes, ladies' fashion shoes. And it was getting more and more difficult. And in 1986, I went out to Taiwan for the first time. And as you say, I went there for 3 months and I traveled around. And I saw them making shoes. And it was just a light bulb moment. I realized straight away that the potential, the future for making shoes in London was very, very grim indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Not only were they making beautiful shoes, but they were half the price of the shoes we were making in our factory. So it was very clear. And I came back and said to my partner, you know, we've got to do something. He was a dyed-in-the-wool manufacturer. He loved making shoes. He was a real technician. So in the end, for a nominal sum, he bought my shares. And I gave up manufacturing and started importing, primarily from the Far East.
What did that feel like, that change? I mean, we're going to go on now into what you then ended up doing. But just that moment of change when you realize basically an entire industry, a workforce, you know, weren't going to be employed in the UK again.
I think my first sensation was that I should have done it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the writing was on the wall. Our orders were getting smaller. More orders were going to Brazil, Italy, the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
Our orders were getting smaller. And I guess I should have stepped back at that moment. And it was a typical example of being so, you know, head down working day to day that I didn't step back and say, you know, the future of manufacturing in the UK is not good. But I think it was just inevitable. I think, you know, it didn't just happen to footwear. It happened to clothing, happened to a whole load of industries where, you know, I think 30% of the cost of making shoes is in the labor. And therefore, you know, if you're making shoes in London, very expensive, you just can't compete.
Mm.
And as I said, it's low technology. It doesn't require any great sophisticated machinery. So, you know, I think it was just inevitable that sooner or later, manufacturing would move. I mean, the only place it hasn't moved is really Italy. And because Italy make just beautiful shoes, you know, they have the craftsmanship, the heritage. And so they make the best shoes in the world. And even China or anywhere else can't really compete with that. But they're the outlier. They're the exception. Most people making pretty standard shoes now, you can make them very, very effectively in other countries, cheaper countries.
I feel as though the entrepreneurial spirit of your ancestors is in your, literally in your DNA. Because as you said, after selling your shares in the manufacturing business, you decided to start importing. And despite the success you had, you felt that there was something missing, which is your brand. And so listening to your story, you know, your grandfather and your father built their businesses with their hands. And I feel as though you were looking to maybe build one with your vision. Do you think the entrepreneurial sort of spirit, the entrepreneurship, is something that has passed down through generations or almost inherited? I mean, I speak to people on this podcast who I talk about eating entrepreneurship with their breakfast. Do you know what I mean? Like it was just being spoken about all the time. So they just sort of don't see it as a thing. Or do you think it was something that you really had to learn?
I think it partly was in my blood. I mean, my family, they've always been self-employed or had their own business. They've never worked for anybody else. And I suppose I grew up in that sort of environment where, you know, it was unusual to work for someone else because none of them had. So I suppose that certainly had a big influence on my life. And I suppose also when I did have a career in accountancy and in banking, I did yearn for running my own business.
Mm.
Now, I wasn't sure it was going to be in shoes. And in fact, I was dissuaded to go into shoes. But
that was the one area you were told, Daniel, not to go into.
And I ended up doing it for 50 years. But there you are. But yeah, I think I always had the sense, even though I wasn't very clear as to what career I wanted to pursue, but I did have the sense, and maybe as you say, it's something that goes right back, that I always wanted to have my own business and run my own thing. And yeah, I didn't really consider, I mean, I thought accountancy was really good training, the banking was good training, but in the end, I wanted my own business. And I think that was partly, as I say, my background, and partly also my overall character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I have a low threshold of boredom, and I sort of just didn't particularly enjoy just doing a run, you know, day-to-day job in an accountancy firm.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm still trying to get over the fact you failed your O-levels in math and then somehow you could become an accountant. Like, I just would find that quite challenging.
It was challenging. I scraped through. I am a fellow of the Institute of Chartered Accountants, so I did make it. It needed a lot of work. But, you know, in the end, actually, I mean, look, not only that, I actually did a degree in accounting. Am I a true masochist? I went to Kent University and studied accounting. Now, fortunately, there wasn't that much accounting in the degree course, but
yeah.
So I've sort of, yeah, I spent a long time in doing accountancy, but
not doing what you should have been doing, which is this. And can I just note to anyone listening, I couldn't not mention this, that the wonderful and colourful and creative Olivia Rubin is your daughter.
Yes, she is. Yes, yes.
And we're a bit obsessed here with rainbow coloured clothing and brand that she has built here at Holly & Co. So I feel like, again, it's in the DNA. It must have been in the breakfast that she was eating as well.
Well, she's very artistic. I mean, she went to Central St. Martin's, and she's also very independent as well. I don't think she ever considered working at June, which was must be a very good thing. And my son is a TV producer. So I think there's a sort of an artistic thread that runs through the family. I mean, my father was actually a violinist before he was persuaded to join the family footwear firm. So there is a sort of artistic sort of
creative
sort of flair that is sort of within the family, I think. Yes,
you must be a very proud dad.
I am, yes. They've both done really well. Yes, yes.
So tell me, we're going to come back to your story here. So tell me about founding June and where the name comes from, because it was in 1992 and I'm sure it must have felt like a huge leap. You've seen the nuts and bolts of the industry, the British shoemakers struggling, you'd understood importing. What was the gap that you saw?
Well, firstly, I think I was doing a lot of work as an importer. You know, we were supplying Next, Marks and Spencers. We were doing everything. You know, we were designing the shoes. We were getting them made. We were getting them quality checked. We were shipping them. We were holding them in our warehouse. But in the sock was Marks and Spencers or Next. So I was thinking I was doing all this work and getting very little reward. And over the years, you know, when I started, it was not many people went to China. But then as communication opened up, more and more people came directly to the UK and my margins got squeezed. So I realized that I couldn't continue just doing unbranded private label. And I thought there was an opportunity to start a brand. And the idea behind the brand was always this concept of affordable luxury. I think the lower price retailers were finding it very difficult because everybody was starting to sell shoes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Next, Marks and Spencers, you know, department stores, clothing stores. They all found that all of a sudden they could just stick a few shoes underneath the clothes with very low cost and sell quite a lot of them.
Mm.
So manufacturing, retailing was becoming very difficult at that lower price level. So I was very much looking for that niche that was, as I say, affordable luxury. So really beautifully made shoes, but not at luxury prices, not at sort of, you know, about a quarter or even less than luxury prices. And that was very much the guiding principle when I set up June in 1992. But at the time, you know, I was running the two businesses parallel.
My goodness.
I mean, the import company was very much funding retail, yes, because, you know, the cost of opening stores, as you know, is really expensive. And it was the profits from the retail company that was enabling us to sustain that growth.
And tell me about where the name comes from.
Well, the name, you know, it's always difficult to get a name because whenever you go and try and get a name, it's always been taken. So I really like the idea, the metaphor of a sand dune. You know, a sand dune is constantly changing its shape in the wind. And that very much is like fashion. Fashion is also constantly evolving and changing. And I thought that sort of metaphor was really good, a really descriptive way of using the brand. And so that's how I got to the name of June.
Oh, I love that. I didn't know that. This is why this is, people are going to be just so, you know, the brand June is like all part of our entire lives as women. And so actually, this is just wonderful to find this all out. And I didn't know this as well, that you started initially June with concessions. And this is where department stores of the time were basically quite willing, weren't they, to support fledgling brands. I mean, Topshop and Miss Selfridge also started this way. And in 1993, you opened your first standalone store on the King's Road. I mean, I have to say that King's Road at that time, the guests I've had on this podcast, where they've had their first store on the King's Road, and it just was a wonderful time. I read that you used the idea you'd seen in Paris to save space as the shop was so tiny. Talk to me about those early days.
Well, as you say, I started in concessions in a clothing store that's unfortunately now closed called J. Norman.
Oh, yes.
A really nice man called Norman Freed gave me an opportunity of putting our concessions into some of his clothing stores. And they were very successful. And that gave us the confidence to look for a store. And as you say, the King's Road was very buzzy at that time. We didn't want a big store. We wanted to keep our costs low. And so we went for this store, 37A King's Road, which was a pretty small, very small frontage. And I was wondering, you know, what concept should I have for the store? And I'd seen in Paris this concept of putting shoes on top of boxes. The great advantage of that was speed of service and also space. You know, the unfortunate thing about shoes is they take up a lot of room.
Mm.
You know, the average clothing store, 99% is used for the shop front. With shoes, about a third is needed to store the stock. So I thought if I could store a lot of the stock on the shop floor, that would make it much more efficient in terms of space utilization. So it was a combination of those factors. And I saw this concept in quite a few shops in Paris. And I thought, let's give that a go because, you know, it's very accessible. It's easy to shop. And that's how I started. I mean, I sort of painted the first shop myself. Wasn't a great sort of design sort of achievement. I mean, it was fine until we then wanted to go into some of the new shopping centres like Bluewater. And then the landlord said, I'm sorry, Daniel, you know, this just isn't good enough for our smart new shopping centre. You need to do something a little bit smarter. So unfortunately, that stage, or fortunately, the on top of the box concept was binned, and we went for something a little bit more aspirational.
Now, I know that for some of you, it might feel a bit early to start thinking about Christmas, but what if doing the groundwork now could change the whole day? Every year, millions of women across the UK face the same old challenges, that age-old pressure of finding incredible gifts, creating magic in the home, and still remembering who likes what or doesn't, on top of working and caring for others. But what if this year was different? At Holly & Co, we're here to bring the joy back. All the fun, the colour, the creativity leading up to the event itself. We've pulled out all of the stops to help you create a Christmas less ordinary. We've curated whole collections full of exciting decorations and unique gift ideas for everyone on your list, along with all kinds of ways to surprise and delight them. From giant Christmas pudding piñatas to cleverly personalised treats and more. Everything we sell is touched by hand and made by a UK small business. So all you need to do is order and enjoy it. To create a Christmas less ordinary, visit holly.co. For now, though, let's get back to our conversation of inspiration. you'd always had the ambitions for June to become a global brand, and with this idea, like you were saying, to create affordable luxury, to create leather shoes that just sort of didn't compromise on the quality, on the design, but that were sold at these affordable prices. So you're hitting that sweet spot. Talk to me about then scaling. You've got your first store. You've understood what the gap in the market was, because I remember speaking to Stuart Trevor, the founder of All Saints, and he spoke about the part of his journey that he said he found it incredibly stressful, sort of juggling all of those balls at once. And just thinking about that stock element that you're talking about, for those of us that with, you know, it really could freak you out with the amount of stock that you would have to have. So talk to me about scaling this gap in the market that you discovered.
Yeah, well, I think what I discovered was that we did need more stores. Then, actually, to some extent, business was a lot simpler because you didn't have the internet.
Yeah.
You know, there was no complications with, you know, dropship marketplaces.
Yeah.
It was just people used to go to the store and buy their shoes.
Yeah.
Which made it very simple. So we started opening stores. Initially, quite slowly.
Because it must be quite expensive to open stores.
Very, yeah. It's hugely, you know, it costs around, I don't know, around £300,000 shop fit.
Yeah, wow.
And then you've got another £100,000 worth of stock. So every store you're opening, you're committing, you know, £400,000. So it was expensive. And I think what we found, and I have found over the years, and actually it's a theme through the book, that opening freestanding shoe stores is not so easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the costs are pretty high. And especially, as I said before, you're competing with clothing retailers that are selling them at a much lower price because they're not paying any occupation costs at all. So the big opportunity for us actually was, yes, stores, but also concessions.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we were in John Lewis and we were doing really well. And the big opportunity for us was to get into House of Fraser, Debenhams, Selfridges, Fenix, because it was much easier to make money in those concessions. Because mm-hmm. instead of having fixed rent and rates, horrible rates, you had a commission.
Mm.
And what that meant was that during the quiet times, during January, February, March, instead of paying those fixed costs and losing money,
mm-hmm.
you were paying a commission. So the big opportunity was to get into concessions, because those were much more profitable than freestanding shoe shops. And it wasn't until 2009 that the acquisition of a company called Shoe Studio transformed our business and tripled us in size, because we then took over a whole load of concessions
mm-hmm.
and became a much bigger business.
And when you're traveling through this, Danielle, obviously you've now... You're a chartered accountant, right? So in terms of those listening, and if you think about those maybe listening, thinking about starting a business, or they have their own businesses, these moments that come along, like the opportunity to acquire that business, did that make you nervous? Or did you think that now, potentially, thanks to your dad, you've got a grip of the numbers? And so actually, do you know what I mean? That you could see what was going to happen. But were these big steps nerve-wracking for you?
They were. I mean, I'm fortunate in a way that I don't get hugely stressed, which is, you know, I manage to sleep pretty well at night. But the acquisition was an incredible opportunity. I had tried to buy Shoe Studio a year before, but the price was too high. It was part of a whole complicated setup with Icelandic banks called Baugur, and in the end, it all went bust. So we managed to buy Shoe Studio for a fantastic, I mean, I think it was about £4 million. And it was an incredibly good buy. And as I say, it gave us an opportunity of getting into concessions, which were hugely profitable. The actual negotiations were quite difficult, because I had to go to the managing directors of the CEOs of Debenhams, House of Fraser, Selfridges, persuade them all that, you know, I would not make a mess of their concessions, that, you know, that I'd do a good job. So there was quite an important job of selling ourselves as a credible sort of partner for them. And fortunately, they were convinced. I think the fact that I'd been in business for quite a long time, you know, our brand was doing well. We were successful in John Lewis. Fortunately, they were persuaded and, you know, the deal went through. At the time, I suppose it was stressful, but as I say, it was a fantastic deal. You know, we bought something like £20 million worth of stock for £4 million. So, you know, in the subsequent years, it proved to be a real sort of...
Game changer
in terms of the business, yes.
Tell me about not getting stressed very easily. Is this like a superpower, Daniel, that you've got or something?
It's certainly not a superpower, no. I think one thing, Holly, is that, you know, if you've been doing it a long time, you do manage to, and I've been doing it a very long time, you do manage to, you've seen lots of things before, you've experienced these things. And So it's not such a shock. You know, you've seen the hard times, the good times. So I think that's an important ingredient, that, you know, that experience. But I suppose also I'm a reasonably sort of, what's the word? I was going to say boring, but, you know, I hope my wife wouldn't say that. A reasonably balanced person. I don't tend to get very upset that easily.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of held me in good stead. And I think it's an important quality, obviously, for an entrepreneur, you know, that you do manage to have a positive outlook, that you manage to take, you know, what inevitably a lot of hard sort of positions over the years and come out of them a stronger person.
I think you're right. I mean, highlighting that sort of optimism, not maybe eternal optimism, well, sometimes you do need to have that. I mean, when you're persuading those department stores that you are going to basically be able to do this, you know, I think one of the draws of founders and what we might be able to do quite well is sell that story and sell that vision and sell that sort of the thing that people can't quite see, and you can bring it to life and with that positivity, right? Because there's no way it's not working in your mind. You know, everyone else can have the doubts, but you can't hold the doubts.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's also just having that sort of inner confidence that you know that you can do a good job. You know shoes, you know the problems.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is, you know, and I'm sure you found over the years, it's about relationships.
Mm.
You know, it's building that trust that people, you know, believe that you will deliver,
yeah,
that you've always sort of been honest with them, that you've, yeah. You know, and over the years, I mean, that's such an important quality, isn't
yeah
it? Just sort of building up that relationship with suppliers, with partners, so that you don't necessarily have to have a legal agreement in place, because you just sort of know
mm-hmm
that you can trust someone
mm-hmm
and you're going to do good by them and vice versa.
When the business was growing, did you find it hard to relinquish control in areas? Because I know that this can be hard for founders. I call it founder-titis that we suffer from. And I read that you are a shoe obsessive and you're basically always involved with the product. So how did you manage this, these changes as it scaled?
Well, at the beginning, not particularly well, to be honest. We had a CEO, and it was like a triumvirate, actually. I was looking after product and marketing. The CEO was looking after sales, retail, and the COO was looking after operations. And with hindsight, I think I must have made the CEO job quite difficult, because what happens if you're the founder is that if someone gets an answer they don't like, they'll knock at Daniel's door and maybe he will help out. And I think I sort of slowly, maybe too slowly, discovered that that wasn't the basis of a good sort of relationship, that I was undermining the authority of the CEO. So
mm-hmm
I have managed to step much more back, much more. As you say, I'm not really involved in the day-to-day at all. I'm not particularly good at it. You know, I've got a low threshold of boredom. I'm not very good on operations and detail, but I am passionate about the product. Interesting on the product, I'm much better identifying what won't sell than what will sell. I mean, often I'm a bit behind the curve in terms of what's happening with fashion. But I really enjoy the product and do get involved in product meetings. And I do get involved in the brand and you know, look at marketing. But I like to think now that the relationship I have with the team is much better than it was. I mean, my main problem is that, and I guess it's an age thing, I get impatient, you know,
mm-hmm
why is everything taking so long? But otherwise, I think it's working pretty well right now.
it's sometimes when I speak to people, it's about feeling nervous about scaling, right? Nervous about scaling, because ultimately, does scaling mean you're stepping away? You know, by scaling, you're bringing more people in. It either means you've got to run it on top of everybody else, or you've got to relinquish control and have a different relationship with the baby that you started, you know, and you're sort of always that's parent in a way, you sort of know, but you've got to entrust the teacher or the nanny or the, you know, the person now looking after it. And I think that that does make people, you know, very nervous.
I think you're right. It was interesting because when the pandemic came along in 2020, our CEO left and we were in the process of searching for a new CEO, but we didn't find one. So between 2020 and 2022, I took over as CEO.
Well, but that wasn't a stressful period of time to take over.
Well, do you know what? It was, but it was fascinating. I was really proud, actually, of what the team achieved. I mean, you know, in terms of communication, in terms of how we managed. I mean, it was disaster. You know, all of our shops were closed. Mm-hmm. No one was buying our shoes. But actually, running the business during that time, I learned a lot about areas I don't really know much about, you know, performance marketing and IT and areas like that. So it was fascinating. But I think I was very clear at the end of it that, you know, I'd reached the end of my tether in terms of managing day to day. I was okay at it, but I'm sure that our current CEO, Nigel, is much better at managing the team. I think he's more patient. I think he's mostly a better manager.
Mm-hmm.
But so, yes, so I think now we're in a good place. But, you know, in answer to your question, I think it took me a little bit of time to adapt to being a founder and chairman.
Yes.
Rather than an interfering sort of CEO.
I mean, you touched on pandemic, which I'm going to come to, but I'm going to fast forward to today. And June has, am I right in saying 350 store locations worldwide? I mean, that is incredible. But I know you will have, you've already touched on from the right at the beginning what changes you've seen, but it seems to be, you know, huge amount of changes have happened over like the last 10, 15 years. You know, we've got the decline of the high street. We've got the loss of a lot of the big names on the high street. We've had Brexit. We've had the pandemic. I mean, it's just been an incredibly difficult decade, let's say. As such a big name on the high street, I'd love to know your thoughts on the future of the high street. I was just reading, actually, I started reading and then I got interrupted and I've saved the paper. But there was a whole article, I think, in the Times this weekend about the high street and its future. And I think a lot of people think that, you know, maybe COVID accelerated what we were already seeing, potentially the drop in footfall. What's your experience been?
I think it's very much two-tier. Look, the first thing I'd say is that the rating system is iniquitous. You know, 75% of rates are paid by retailers who occupy 25% of the properties. So, you know, this system does not exist in any other country in the world. So, you know, if we pay, for example, a rent on an expensive store of £300,000, we're paying an extra £150,000 for rates. And that, for a lot of businesses, is a killer.
Mm.
So I think the government's got to sort that out. I think what we're seeing now on the high street is very much a two-tier system. You've got those really vibrant high streets where people have invested. We've got local retailers doing a brilliant job, the local butcher, local grocer. And I think there are a few of those where the councils have been quite innovative, quite encouraging. But then you've got a lot that are really dying. You know, there are so many high streets you go to and it's just charity shops, vape shops, you know, nail shops, coffee bars, but very few actual shops.
Mm.
So I think you have got a major problem. I mean, I've got a place in France and I go to Italy a lot on business. And there they protected their high streets.
Mm.
They haven't allowed some of the horrible developments of, you know, the 1960s. Some of those shopping centres were just horrible, disastrous. Mm. So I think there is a need to rethink the high street because I think it's such an important part of people's daily life.
Yes.
And the reality is that a lot of high streets are just disintegrating, are just falling apart. And I think that is a huge shame. And I don't think, you know, the government have really got to grips with how to deal with it.
And it's funny you should say that, because I was going to mention in my notes here that I've just come back from a weekend in Paris, and I basically went giddy, you know, giddy at the experience, because obviously as a retailer myself, but as a shopaholic and a retailer, watching the amount of independence, the amount of creativity, the amount of people basically sharing their vision through a physical store, and the joy of the customers coming in. You know, it was like it was a shopping, you could see shopping was a pastime. You know, it was something that you went and did on a Saturday. You know, this is something you just did. I suppose it made me realize fundamentally that we're starved of that in the UK. We're starved of what it used to be. And what a shame that is. And so now, if you are starting a business, not one of your first things will you be thinking, I must physically manifest my business. You know, I must have a physical manifestation of my company. It's not going to be the first thing you're thinking, is it?
No.
You're just literally going to think, right, it all has to be digital.
Yes.
Because there's no way I could afford what you've just spoken about.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a shame. I think you've got to be very, very brave to open a store. And even then, you know, one store, the economics of a single store,
yes,
usually don't make sense. You know, yeah, when I started, I found that I needed at least half a dozen stores to manage the stock, to get mm-hmm. the overhead spread across a number of units.
Mm-hmm.
So opening a single store, unless you're a sort of a corner shop and the whole family is working there,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
otherwise it's really, really difficult.
And of course, you also trade internationally. So particularly now with the US, so I imagine it must be a very fine balancing act when you're facing, you know, so you've got all of that going on, and then you've got the changing political landscapes all the time. I'm thinking, of course, of the tariffs that have been introduced. How have you been able to navigate those challenges? And I suppose, you know, basically remain sort of an ever-evolving business, even though you're now quite a big business. Do you see what I mean? So it's fine to be a chameleon when you're young and starting out, but you've got 350 stores, so it's quite difficult to roll with it.
I think the we're going through a transformation. You know, the future for June is not necessarily in freestanding stores. The future for us is as a global footwear and accessories brand. One of the things that acquiring Shoe Studio did was actually pushed us back on that curve, because the concessions were retail, mm-hmm. and we had stock and we had people serving the concessions. But actually, the future of June is as a global brand. And as a global brand, a lot of that is not necessarily opening stores, but selling to third parties. So our business in the States is very much through Nordstrom, Dillard's,
mm-hmm.
two of the major department stores, or working with franchise partners, as we do in the Middle East. So I think the future for us is very different from what it was historically. As I say, I think the future as a pure play footwear retailer is much more difficult.
Mm.
The future as a global accessories and footwear brand is very exciting. And that's really where we're focusing our efforts, is building the brand, building our marketing, getting the right celebrities to wear our product,
mm-hmm.
having the right distributors in different countries, having the right franchise partners. That is proving to be hugely successful. And that's certainly where I see the future. You know, one of the lessons I've found over the years is that having soulless freestanding shoe stores is not easy, for the reasons I've said.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, we do fantastically well with someone like Next. We're the best, we're the most successful fashion footwear retailer on Next platform. We're doing huge business with Marks and Spencers. We are the number one partner with John Lewis. Those are the opportunities, I think, for the brand going forward.
Mm.
And our website. The website's doing very well, but not so much in stores. Really, stores is much more about key stores. in key locations that are really beacons for the brand.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we found is if you have those stores, it helps greatly for your online sales.
Mm.
So that's what I see the future of June. Very different, I suppose, from where I started off with stores.
And do you think that's one of the sort of superpowers that you think that you possess or that successful entrepreneurs do, which is that sort of ability to pivot and change? You know, in 2022, June turned 30 years old, and sort of sensing that it's time to change direction or sensing how you can stay relevant.
I think you're absolutely right. When you look at the businesses that have not done that, you know, unfortunately, if you look at the high street, you know, the Topshops, Dorothy Perkins, there's a whole list of them.
Mm.
They haven't changed. And then you look at someone like a Zara.
Yeah.
And you look at how clever they are in newness and creating an environment that is so premium, but which is such good value. So, yeah, I think that ability to pivot, to change is absolutely crucial. I mean, one of the lessons I learned writing the book, in many occasions, I was too slow to change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was too slow to close my factory. I was too slow to stop being an importer and seeing my margins reduce. Look, I suppose the good thing is I did eventually see the light and I made those changes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is maybe the most important thing for an entrepreneur is that ability to change, to see the future. You know, you hear the stories of people working away night and day. And when you listen to their story, you think, oh no, this has got no chance.
Mm.
And yet they have devoted all their life and their savings to doing it. So that ability to step back, look at the future, see where the opportunities are, make those changes in a considered and well-planned way, I think is just one of the main secrets of being a successful entrepreneur.
I mean, I love tapping into this because this is, you know, real life learnt experience, you know, lessons from experience. You know, this is what you know. Do you think you're faster now after 50 years of doing this?
I think we are. As I say, my problem is impatience. You know, when we have an idea, I want it executed really, really quickly. And the reality is it's not so easy. You can't just, you know, click your fingers and it happens. So I do need a degree of patience. But yeah, I think that is the key. I think it's being able to see into the future. But, you know, I'm sure you found, you know, there's a great difference between having the strategy and executing that strategy.
Yeah.
You know, over the years, we've had so many good ideas, but when they're not executed really, really well,
yeah,
then, you know, you can end up in a mess. And I think, so you do need both. You need to have a clear strategy, 5-year plan, but then you need to have the right people, the right processes. You know, business is so complex now. You need the right processes. You know, using AI where it's applicable to in order to implement it and execute it brilliantly. Because I think that's a lot of failures of those businesses that have not been successful is they may have had the strategy, but they just didn't execute it as well as maybe they should have.
And don't you find also it's then in the execution the magic can be drained, right? So due to the processes, due to all of those things, that actually the initial idea and why it was so sparky and caught your attention, by the time it gets to the execution, it's nowhere to be seen, right? And I think that's also what the founder has to be there to protect that element as well, which can just be almost the process can just de-shine it, so to speak.
I think you're right. I think there's a great danger of overcomplicating things.
Mm.
You know, if you can keep, and you know, and life is, business is complicated right now, there's no doubt about it. But I think having that vision, you know, be able to simplify it, to prioritize it, you know, what's really important here? I think the problem often is that there's so many different things to do that you spend too much time on the unimportant things and not enough time on doing the really important things. And I think that is key. You know, if you look at the successful entrepreneurs over the time, they've had a laser sharp, you know, the Steve Jobs of this world, a laser sharp vision about what needs to be done. And they are uncompromising in delivering that.
Yeah, obsessive.
Yeah, obsessive, exactly, yes.
So after weathering these 50 years in business, what would you say to the small business community listening and how they can navigate through? I mean, you know, just in the last couple of questions, you know, I've mentioned the decline of the high street, COVID, Brexit, tariffs. You know, these are huge things that have come your way. What would you say has been sort of a guiding principle, something that you might have followed?
I think the first thing is to make sure that your business idea is doable, is realistic. You know, I think the more you can question that, you know, do your research so that you feel really confident that your plan is well thought through, that you're not going to run out of money on the way, mm-hmm. that you've done a robust business plan. And if you need help with that, get it. But I think that's the first thing, is to have a clear vision about what you want to do and to make sure that the plan is robust. I think for me, the second thing that is just so important is if you really believe in that, then you've got to get out there and sell. Mm. You know, sell, sell, sell. I mean, you learn so much by getting into the market, by challenging yourself, by getting feedback from people. You know, then you can change the product or you can change the service. So I think it's those two things. I think make sure that you really do your research up front. And when you're confident you've done that, then really go for it. Mm-hmm. And listen to what people are saying, you know, because often you just learn a lot from feedback. Mm-hmm. You know, people who've got experience, people who've maybe bought that product, who can see flaws in it that maybe you didn't. So I think for me, those are the two key ingredients, is that ability to have that vision, but then really to go for it and to put every effort into, you know, going and trying to sell it. I mean, that's what I had to do, I think, when I started importing. You know, I spent my time going up and down the motorway visiting customers. A lot of them got fed up with me knocking on their door. Some of them, I think, eventually thought, even though I wasn't, that I was a supplier. But, you know, it was that persistence, which I think is a greatly underestimated quality.
Yes.
That enabled me to just sort of break through. And maybe they felt sorry for me in the end. And they said, okay, Daniel, we'll give you an order. Unfortunately, the order worked out and it was successful. So, yeah. I would say those are super important qualities to have.
I've talked on here previously about Royal Mail's international sending services for any founders listening that are thinking about expanding internationally. I'll be the first to admit that posting items abroad can sometimes feel daunting with things like tariff changes and customs paperwork, but it doesn't need to be. Royal Mail's click and drop service takes all that confusion away and makes it easy to start exporting. When buying international postage online, click and drop will ask you for all of the information you need to provide. And when you pay, including any tariff charges, all of your customs documents are printed along with the label. Visit parcel.royalmail.com to see how easy it is. And now back to Conversations of Inspiration. I do like the fact that you've touched on sales, just selling. There is something, isn't there, about now, potentially with the social media, with it almost like a digital protection, so to speak, you sort of allow it to sell you. Whereas actually just getting in front of people and, you know, hardcore selling yourself and your business in front of another human being, I think that that muscle probably was worked far more back in the past than it is today, you know, where you literally feel like you've got your bag in hand, you know, your little suitcase or your, you know, whatever you're creating. And then you put your wares on the table and you are selling it. And I think there's such a power in that that maybe we don't talk about a lot nowadays.
I think you're right. And I think if you take the Americans, I think they're much better at that than we are.
Yes.
You know, they are very, very determined. They won't take no for an answer. Now, that doesn't always go down well with an UK audience because, you know, we think it's going to be a little bit pushy. It's not quite right.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got to admire it because I think that is the way to get business done.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, with the digital age, there is a danger of becoming into a sort of your own little sort of world, a little bit divorced what's happening outside. And I think that's a shame because I think you can learn so much by just getting out there and talking to people.
Yeah.
And getting feedback, honest feedback. Because that I think, can be transformational in terms of progressing your business plan.
When you were writing, I'm coming full circle, but from the start of this podcast, back to your memoir, Soul Survivor, reflecting on the last 50 years that you spent in business. It obviously was probably a joy to write, but was there clarity in reflecting over this huge chunk of time? I mean, firstly, did you take stock and give yourself a pat on the back?
I think one of the things about entrepreneurs is that you don't tend to look...
We just do not do that.
No, you tend to think about the next problem rather than
the last one.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so I probably could have answered that. But was there clarity in a sense of what matters to you now moving forward? Being able to reflect on, being able to spend that time looking at your past and all of those things that have happened. And were you able to join some dots up?
I think so, yes. Yeah, I think one of the things it did was to highlight some of the serial mistakes that I made, which wasn't a particularly enjoyable sensation. But I think that was interesting. I think it did, you know, I think, you know, I love history. I like listening to history. And I think you do learn a lot from it. And so that process of writing the book, I did understand a lot about what I did wrong and actually what I did right. So, yeah, I think I find it hugely valuable in terms of just trying to get a clear idea about, you know, where you are, where you sit, what the opportunities are. So, yeah, it was, as you said at the beginning, it was a cathartic experience and one that actually I enjoyed a lot. Traveling was fantastic. You know, I got the opportunity of visiting 30 countries I'd never have visited.
Yeah.
You know, my wife is not a keen traveler and she she wouldn't have gone to Vietnam or Indonesia or the Philippines or all these other places, but I did have the opportunity. And I think that's actually one of the main things, meeting some really inspirational people. You know, shoes are difficult. They're tough. And the people that are in the shoe trade tend to have a sort of a grittiness and a determination, which makes them really interesting company. I think that's most probably the thing that I've learned most is just that enjoyment of meeting people, getting out there, experiencing lots of different things that, quite frankly, if I'd been a chartered accountant, I would never have done.
No, and thank goodness you didn't keep going in that career. Otherwise, my goodness. I mean, tell me, at the end of this podcast, and I'm wondering what you're going to say, and I'm also thinking about how proud, I mean, I don't know if you reflect on this in your book, that your father and your grandfather would be, right? That the chartered accountant career didn't, you know, you didn't follow dad's advice and actually you did follow in their footsteps. Towards the end of this podcast, I do ask my guests about the roller coaster, which you fully well know you have been on over the last 50 years. What would you say has been one of your biggest, lowest moments, you know, the time where you feel sick in your stomach?
No doubt it was the pandemic, you know.
Yeah.
The pandemic came along, we had to close all of our stores. People were at home. They were wearing trainers or slippers.
Yeah, we were selling. Say, it's not one of those businesses selling, where you go, oh, so then everyone's just going to buy. Well, no, and no one was going out.
Exactly. So, and if they were buying shoes, they certainly weren't buying fashion shoes from June.
Yeah.
So that was really a very, very tough period because, you know, we were losing lots of money. We had a bit of support, obviously, from the government with a furlough scheme and didn't get much support from landlords, unfortunately. But that was the low point. I really didn't know whether we'd get through that because we were just so badly positioned to cope with it.
Mm.
You know, we lost, I think we must have lost about £25 million during that period.
My goodness me.
And that is a massive hit to our balance sheet. So that was without doubt the lowest point, I think, in my long career.
Yeah, well, it would be. And conversely, your highest high?
I think when we took over Shoe Studio and tripled our size, I think I suddenly realized, you know, we were now a major player within the industry, that we were now being distributed through Selfridges, through all the major department stores. So I think that was most probably the biggest high, just achieving that acquisition at a really, really good price and projecting us into a different sort of sphere within our industry.
Amazing. Well, Daniel, this has just been a fantastic time to connect, get to know you more, get to know June more, to hear about the 50 years. There's not many of you, Daniel, out there. Do you know what I mean? No, there's not many.
I don't know whether to be proud or embarrassed.
Hugely proud. Are you joking me? It's hugely proud. We need people like you. My God. You know, people who are still holding up their brands and, you know, caring. And it's not just shareholders and just invisibleness. You know, it feels so good to speak to you. It's that time of the podcast, though. I am going to hand over to you to read a letter that you've prepared for your younger self. And just thank you so much in advance, Daniel.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much, Holly. I've greatly enjoyed it.
Me too.
Good.
Over to you.
So this is a letter to my younger self. Dear Daniel, whilst writing my memoir of 50 years in the shoe trade, I had a lot of time to reflect on the decisions I made, the mistakes and successes. Thinking about my early years, I was aware that I was too risk-averse. Because I was afraid of rejection, I held back both in relationships and in business. I urge you to be braver than I was. The worst that can happen is that people say no, and in many cases, they could well say yes. It was only later when I started my own business that I was forced to be more assertive, as otherwise it would never have worked. I encourage you to speak to people who can give you good advice and a different perspective. These conversations are hugely valuable in helping you form your ideas. Don't be afraid to seek advice. Most people are more than willing to share their ideas, although in the end, you need to decide what's right for you. Building strong ties with colleagues and partners is an essential ingredient for a successful career. People will make that extra effort to support you if you build a relationship based on mutual respect and trust. It is so important you find a career that you enjoy. We spend so much of our time at work that you don't want to look back with regrets. Although it has been an ongoing challenge, I don't regret my 50 years in footwear. However, there were times during my career when I got so sucked into the detail that I didn't step back and look at the big picture. If I had, I would have made different decisions. You will make mistakes along the way. I certainly have. But learn from these mistakes. Be resilient, but always have a positive attitude. Finally, and most importantly, get things in perspective. I have found that having a strong family foundation and good friends is essential for a fulfilling and rewarding life. So make sure you devote time to nurturing these relationships. Much love, Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel, so much. You know, when you're reading that, you just feel how lucky we are as listeners to get your insight. As you say, you're a rare thing. And so actually to hear what you would say back to that younger Daniel is just a real honour. And I think one of the things that resonated there for me is getting things in perspective and investing in those relationships that basically are your scaffolding through this journey. You know, and without them, we couldn't have done, you know, built the businesses that we have. You know, that these are the people that hold you up in the tough times. And I can imagine that you relied heavily on them through that period of COVID.
Very much so, yes. I mean, I'm very fortunate to have a close family And as I say, they've been hugely supportive, and it would have been very, very difficult to achieve what I have without that support.
Daniel, thank you again for your time today. I wish you decades more fun with your beautiful brand, June.
Thank you very much, Holly. I've really enjoyed it. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.